Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On and licensed social worker Xander Kagg, and we have a guest today, Lucas Hall. He is a trans man and an advocate for trans inclusion and well-being in all areas of society. He previously sat on the advisory board of the Palm Beach County Human Trafficking Coalition while working at a Florida LGBTQ center as a transgender youth coordinator and LGBTQ plus victim services advocate. He has led initiatives such as LGBTQ human trafficking panels, been a guest speaker and trainer for human trafficking issues related to the LGBTQ plus community, and has a huge passion for raising awareness for all the ways trans lives are most vulnerable. He himself is a survivor of human trafficking as a minor and cares deeply about bringing a stop to human trafficking and child sexual abuse and exploitation. Welcome, Lucas.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Your journey has brought you full circle to where you are today doing this advocacy work. And as a trans man, you're able to reach a population that ordinarily, A, wouldn't be even seen, which is the male population, and B, the trans male within that population. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so when I was trafficked, I was living as a female and was taken by a lesbian from church. So it's definitely an interesting, different story. Living as a male and a trans male now, it's been interesting to see how sexual trauma is not hugely talked about in either population. I mean, you're right. Both of the male and the trans people are not seen as well and as much, which is very sad. Everybody that's affected by this should be seen and supported. So I'm happy to help raise some awareness through my own story about how all kinds of lives are impacted by human trafficking.
When did it all start?
Well, it all started when I was a child. I went through a lot of sexual trauma for years from a very, very young age. And then the trafficking happened when I was 14 years old. I was in a regular church in East Texas, and an older girl who had been visiting a few times, who was a known lesbian in the group, asked if I would go to get ice cream with her after youth group. It was a Wednesday night, and my mom, of course, wasn't there. And I didn't see any harm in going to get ice cream with somebody in the youth group. And so I started to see the problem after I left, but essentially she got me in her truck, told me that we're going to pull over at a gas station on the way out of town for me to call my mom and tell my mom I wouldn't be home for a while. And I still didn't think anything of it. I just thought, you know, she wants me to give my mom a heads up when she comes to pick me up from youth group. Why I'm not there, I'll be home. You know, I was thinking maybe in an hour or so, which turned into a very long, rough night for me. So yeah, I just remember going to the payphone, still not understanding anything, and telling my mom, you know, I wouldn't be home for a while. And she was pretty clear about not giving my mom any details and hanging up quickly. And again, I thought it was just because she thought my mom would try to stop me and, you know, no, you need to come home, can't go get ice cream with your friend. So me being 14 and naive and probably somewhat rebellious, I went along with it. Yeah, it just did not turn out how I thought it was going to turn out that night.
People have misguided impressions about human trafficking. In a lot of these cases, it's always assumed that it's a white van or some vehicle that pulls up and kidnaps the person. And while those circumstances do exist and do occur, the normative operation that is practiced on a daily basis throughout the world isn't like that. It's very similar to what you just talked about, somebody you know.
Right.
Over the course of your lifetime, when did it occur to you, if it did at all, that you were in a situation that you couldn't escape?
So it was years down the road that I didn't even know what human trafficking was. And it's never something I'd even heard about. So it was years later that I realized what had happened to me was human trafficking. But it was in the moment that it was happening that I realized there's not a way out of this. And at one point when I could have, quote, run, I was terrified. I mean, I was completely shell-shocked and I was naked, wrapped up in a blanket. And so there was nothing that I could do in the middle of nowhere. I didn't know where I was. It was the middle of the night. I was in a trailer park being passed between houses. My clothes were taken from me, my belongings, until they were done. And so there was a gun in the second house that I was sent to with drugs. And I was terrified. It was definitely the most traumatizing instance I've ever been in. Somebody that's lived through a lot of sexual trauma. I was even raped after that at 16. That was by far the most traumatizing. It is a feeling of complete powerlessness, complete vulnerability. Your body is being used and taken from you with no power of your own. And then you have no idea when it's going to stop because the situation just continues. This house, then this house, this person, now this person. And thankfully, that next morning, after that had all happened that night, the girl that initially took me came with my clothes and, you know, said, we're going to somebody else's house across town. I'm taking you to a friend of mine. And it was at that moment I realized I didn't know what trafficking was because I had never heard of the word, but I knew this was about to get even uglier. And I may never see my mom again. I may not survive. At any point, I could be killed. I could die of just heartbreak. I struggled with suicide attempts already and something like a lot because of my sexual trauma. So something like this very well could have led me to suicide. But that morning, it was a Thursday, and we were driving back through, it was Tyler, Texas. We were about 45 minutes outside of Tyler in the country. And we were driving through about 10 or so in the morning, and a cop pulled over the vehicle. I was so thankful. I didn't know why. I didn't know what was happening, but I was like, oh my God, this is actually happening. And he ran the plates, got her information, and turns out this girl had a warrant for arrest. And she looked at me and she's like, I can tell you're not okay. So she called her back up, took me. And I have been forever grateful for that officer. I believe her name was Barbie. I've been forever grateful for her realizing that something wasn't right. And I had asked her, I said, why did you pull her over? And she said, because she had a minor in the car on a Thursday. It's a school day. There's no reason why a minor should be in the car. And I'm like, thank God somebody's paying attention. We could have literally been going to get ice cream and that could be my sister, but that wasn't the situation. So thankfully she had a warrant out for arrest. And that's when my situation ended as far as trafficking, thank God. And I know that for so many others, it never stops. Or it goes on for years, and it's way more violent and hopeless than my situation was. Not to downplay my situation, just to show that I know how severe it is, and my heart aches for this to stop.
Somebody was looking out for you.
I do believe that, yes.
The odds of being stopped because there's a minor sitting next to someone is slim to none. Most people wouldn't even bat an eye. For our audience, I just want them to be aware that human trafficking is through force and coercive methods, but also what some of us deem trauma bonding. I don't think a lot of people understand the term trauma bonding and what that entails in many of these cases with individuals who really believe that the person they're with doesn't sound like that was in your situation, but in many of these situations, as you well know, they believe that that person has their best interest at heart when that isn't the case at all. It's all about the money, the bottom line.
Yeah, money or whatever they're getting out of it, drugs, anything, whatever the payoff is, right?
Lucas, tell us how you gathered yourself all after everything that happened to you. How long did that take? What did it entail?
Well, it's definitely been a lifetime of unlearning, of healing, of growth, of recognizing things in myself that I need to address and go in back to therapy for or whatever. And I'm very open to that. I mean, even at 36 now, I recognize when I need more work, right, done on me. But that was at 14. And I, like I said, I was already in a pretty bad mental spot with suicidal attempts and ideation, dealing with my own trauma, dealing with being trans. I realized I was a boy at 12, even though I didn't have the words for being trans. That time was when my hormones were shooting off and I just was all over the place. My mom was incredibly supportive of me as a person and did her best to help me, but I was so wounded that there was nothing my mom could do to really help me. It was so bad. And I was suffering so deeply, and she was at a loss for what to do for me. I was at a loss. I mean, I was, like I said, I was raped again at 16. And at that point, I had to stand on trial for that situation. That was very traumatizing, having to repeat to the courts every graphic detail of my situation. In a way, I was happy to get justice, but in a way, I felt like I didn't deserve it. Or anyway, I did it because this guy was a registered sex offender. And the attorney told me that he had already molested an 8-year-old boy. And I felt like that was reason for me to testify so that no one else could be hurt, still not fully valuing my own life. But at that point, I had been to a Christian group home for at-risk youth when I was 13, and I got kicked out of there for some behavioral issues and running away. I asked my mom if I could go back. I said, I need to be in a safe bubble. I felt safe there, even though I couldn't be gay. I knew that I needed to be there emotionally, spiritually, everything. And I begged her. I called the CEO of the girls' home and she said, "You're a liability. We can't have you back." And I was like, "No, I know it's God's will for me to be here." And I said, "Please just give me a meeting." I've asked for a lot of meetings in my life, people just to give me a chance, like just hear me out. And I'm really thankful she did. You know, she put a bunch of rules on me, no cutting. You can't act out with any of the girls romantically, no running away. And I said, "I won't." And I was also on a lot of medication at the time for like mood stabilization, depression. And I told her, I said, "I know that God's going to heal me and I'm not going to be on these medications anymore." And it took a while for that to happen. I've been off all meds now for 6 years and I've been transitioning for 8. And it was through my transition and a lot of healing that I've been able to find what actually has leveled me out and stabilized me, helped me to be more healthy. It was never the medication. And I understand for some people that does help them. But in my case, it wasn't. So I'm thankful that I was able to see that outcome. I was in that group home from age 16 and a half to 18. I graduated high school there. When I graduated, they asked me to be staff. So I became staff. I eventually became head dorm parent. It was my favorite job. It's been my favorite job to this day. Just living life with those girls and teaching them, walking literally every day beside them, teaching them the love of God, showing them understanding and compassion for their own struggles. Just being a non-judgmental presence in their life was such a gift to me. And so I cherish that closely. But it was through that that really helped me learn self-control. It helped me learn who God is and who I am in God and start to develop a new identity, a new truth about myself. And that was a long journey of actually coming full circle. Now I can say that I know who I am in God. I know that I'm worthy. I know that I deserve respect and love. And I look for that. And my standards are equivalent to that. But that took a long time. And I've been in therapy since I was a kid. So a lot of EMDR, talk therapy, CBT, DBT, a lot of different types of therapy, a lot of prayer. I believe in prayer. I have a very strong, deep faith in God. And it is directly by his spirit that I have been healed from so much and delivered from strongholds and really things that could have destroyed my life, a lot of darkness. And I feel like that's what the human trafficking is. It's darkness and it's the powers of this world are hurting people. And it's going to take a lot to get that to stop. And I'm thankful that God has brought me this far to be healed and restored. And granted, I'm still on that journey. I'm not saying that I'm 100% all there, but there's still things that come up for me. I have enough ground where I have healing. I know how to get healing. I'm open to different methods as well. I just did a body work session a couple weeks ago where they target organ systems in the body and they heal you they heal your trauma through that. And it was incredibly powerful for me. So I love learning new ways and holistic ways to heal and to grow, to just expand spiritually and personally. So it's been a journey. I get a lot of growth and healing from being authentic. I've never really not been able to just be me, take it or leave it. But I just find pride and freedom in showing up who I am as who I am and allowing other people to show up as they are. Because by me sharing my story or being goofy or, you know, just being honest, it allows other people to show up with whatever they're carrying and be able to lay it down together and say, "Hey, this is me. Let's work on this. And I know that you have capacity to love me and I can love myself."
That's a lot of work.
A lot of work. It can be exhausting, but it's worth it.
In your advocacy work, when you're connecting with people, and you initially have that hesitancy that you see come about between you and the other person, what do you do? What do you do to help them connect with you?
So I pay attention to a lot of things, body language, and I'm pretty good at reading people and their emotions and kind of what's going on. I pay attention to that. And again, I show up authentic, and I believe that I'm a gentle, honest, caring person. And I feel like when you meet people with that, it makes them more likely to meet you the same way, or at least not be defensive or super guarded. I'm also very protective of myself. So if I ever sense that I'm in danger or this is not going to go well, then I'm probably not going to engage anyway. So as I talk to people, again, I've already kind of tried to assess where they're at, but I love to listen. So I might lead with some questions and try to understand where they're at, what their story is. If it's a parent with a trans kid, I'll just kind of ask, "Tell me about your kid. Tell me about your family." And they'll tell me where they're at with everything. And I like to try to understand the root causes. Like, what is making you against your child being trans or your child exploring this different gender identity or sexual orientation. And oftentimes it is, I'm afraid for their safety, or I just don't understand. Like, how could they identify as another gender? That doesn't make any sense. Or it is based in religion. And so my background, kind of being able to touch on all these things, I just meet them with compassion. And when I start sharing a little bit about myself, I realize that when people hear about you, they're more open to sharing about them. And lead with whatever I feel in my spirit is appropriate for the time, even if it doesn't make sense. And I have seen a lot of things happen in those moments, a lot of breakthrough.
You're with the Florida LGBTQ Center as a youth coordinator, and that, I would imagine, calls you out at all hours of the night, all hours of the day, 7 days a week. It's a commitment. It's a strong commitment. And when you're doing that work, do you see potential in other people who remind you of yourself, where you can say, I think this person's going to end up doing what I'm doing in life?
Yes, 100%. There's been some amazing youth come through our program that have so much potential. And any chance I got, I would speak that to them just to encourage them and let them know that there's good in you. There's vibrance and life. And, you know, you have this is what I see in you. Here is somebody that can point things out in other people and draw it out and enable them to go be that leader, go be that light for others. And then just encouraging people to walk through their own healing journey. A lot of those kids were very broken and hurt. A lot of them had been through trauma. And I was a huge proponent of supporting them in that and getting the healing and the recovery that they needed so that they could live their best lives.
I live in a very tourist sector, and we have a lot of Airbnbs and vacation rentals by owner. The focus has been on noise ordinance primarily, and the worry among the citizens when they feel they're outnumbered and they're maybe one of four families living on a street among 17 houses, and the rest are Airbnbs or these vacation rentals by owner. But I always go back to that piece of the human trafficking and even the labor trafficking, and it's always in the forefront of my brain. And recently I was interviewed and asked, and I really struggled with this, Lucas. I was asked, so what do you advise the listener to do? And you mentioned sometimes it's not safe. And if you don't feel safe, you don't connect. You protect yourself at all costs. But my message was contact the Polaris number. And in some instances, if that isn't available, then call the police. And I said that, but then afterwards, I struggled with it because I know in some areas of the country, the police are not well trained, even though that's a piece that everyone's working on. We're all wanting to see better training, better outcomes. But I did struggle with that piece. And I think very affirming to hear you mention how you were spared because of this officer who pulled you over. Do you think she had training?
I think, not to sound a certain way, I think being a female has a lot to do with it. I mean, I just think being a woman, you're more probably aware of different types of situations. Maybe you have like a higher sensitivity to like domestic violence or sexual abuse. I could be wrong, but I do feel like because she was a female officer, she was more keen to recognize that and more sensitive to it. Definitely sensitive to me as a child and as a female at the time. Handling that situation, she was very gentle with me and understanding. Like, I didn't even have to say for her to like basically know what was happening here. And maybe it's just my experience, but I just haven't been around a whole lot of men that have been gentle and kind and intuitive. So, and about the police thing, I know that it can be a very sensitive thing for the LGBT community to reach out to police or to feel safe with them because of the things that have been endured by our community. And I have had some pretty rough experiences myself as well in that case. So that's something also to highlight. And I think that the more that officers can get trained in not only human trafficking, but LGBT lives, the more sensitive and aware they can be to these situations. And then also the misconception that trafficking doesn't happen to boys or to men is not true.
We are going to take a commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. We are speaking with Lucas Hall, and he has an incredible story to share with everyone. Let's pick up where we left off.
We all need protection. We all need safety, and it can happen to absolutely anybody, any race, any age, any religion, any gender, any sexual orientation.
Have you had an opportunity to do some training with the police?
I have. Yes. When I lived in Florida, I got that honor, and it was pretty incredible. So I've always wanted to work more in that way, like whether it be training officers in the LGBT thing or human trafficking or both. I have a lot of respect for law enforcement, even though my relationship with them can be a little complicated. I do want to help. And maybe that's just my heart wanting to help everywhere. But I just want people, especially people in power. So law enforcement, politicians, they have power and authority to make change or to enforce something, right? And it's really important and crucial for those groups of people to be trained and aware, and of course, as unbiased and not prejudiced as possible, so that everybody can get the help and safety that they need.
When you were talking about the group home and you wanted to go back, you felt connections there that maybe you wouldn't have had that experience anywhere else. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why that it's not always a negative, but in your case, it turned out quite well. You managed to graduate from high school.
Yeah, well, this particular group home was very well run. Say we were well staffed, possibly underpaid. Granted, it was ministry a long time ago, and it was in the country, so it was very removed. There was like a boys' home next door, and then a mailbox, post office box in the city, and that was about it. For me, it felt safe because I was surrounded by what felt to me like safe people, minus the whole "you can't be gay" here. That really wasn't even the highlight of my issue at the point at that time in my life. Maybe that would have turned me off if that was my main issue, right? Or something. I was looking for that to be validated at the time, but it wasn't. And then I was surrounded by girls. So again, me feeling safer and more comfortable around women because of my history being violated primarily by men, except for this one situation where it was a female. I just felt comfortable. And I felt like, for the most part, I was understood. And even when I wasn't understood, because there were times when the CEO would literally tell me, "I don't know how to help." And when you're 16 and somebody with 40 years of ministry experience who's worked with thousands of kids tells you, "I don't know how to help you," that feels pretty hopeless. And the solution was always go back to God. What does he say? Go read your Bible, go pray. And truly, that's what I would do every single time. And every single time, the storm would cease. I would get peace in my spirit. The cloud would clear and I could keep going. I was very determined to be there to make it. And I did. And I do credit the majority of that to the group home, but also my relationship with God and how he's faithfully showed up for me every single day and showed me things that I never would have seen in life and myself. He gave me hope, purpose. That's when I felt called to preach when I was 17, when I was there and I was laid in the back of the chapel in worship on my face, praying. I was a little charismatic and I still am. But I remember hearing him call me to preach. And I was like, that's funny. And it's something that had never crossed my mind. And from that point, I embraced it. I've always said yes to him. And I was like, God, I don't understand this. And I'm a girl and blah, blah, blah. You know, how am I going to do this? And he just slowly started to show me different interpretations of scripture around women who do preach. And then later throughout my life, when I came out as gay and trans again as an adult, that is something that I disqualified about myself. Told by people, you can never walk in your purpose. You can never have the anointing of God if you're gay or if you're trans. And for a while, I just kind of put that coat on and wore it. Even though I didn't believe it, I was just so down and out that I wore it for a while. And then when I finally came to grips with my sexual orientation and my gender identity, and I merged that with my faith, and I was at peace with that, I still felt disqualified to, quote, serve God, because I was like, who's going to receive a gay trans guy? How can I do the work of God when no one's going to receive this or think I'm valid or whatever? And so it was another couple years of walking that path that God continued to reaffirm in my spirit, I've called you to preach. And I mean, I would just sit there in my car listening to worship music and break down just weeping because I felt so strongly that he was calling me to do this. And I don't know how it's going to look. I don't know any of that, but I know what he spoke and I believe it. And I was convicted about a year ago to accept the gifts that he's given me and stop pushing them away. Stop saying that you're not good enough. Stop discrediting yourself for whatever reason. That's not honoring God. The self-deprecation is not honoring God. So I repented of that. I said, God, I'm sorry that I have not been honoring what I know that you spoke to me, what you've given me. And I choose to honor you with it. And however you want to show up, however you want to use me, I say yes to you and I'm willing. And so from then, I've just been like trying to put myself in a little more of an open position. If somebody were to call on me to come share my story or just share the word of God, I'm open to that and I will do so faithfully.
Do you have a sense of peace, Lucas, when people find out that you are a trans guy? Do you have a sense of peace that it really isn't that much of an issue to them?
It depends. A lot of times when people find out, it's because I have told them or disclosed it, or they're in an environment where I have said it's safe and it's okay for people to know, like my church. So generally, it's not really an issue, but there are times when I guard that and I don't let that be something that is found out, or I'm very mindful about it not being found out because I never know what's going to happen or how people are going to react. I have been met with a lot of grace. There has been a lot of people throughout my life that have been understanding and gracious. Even if they don't understand me or that part of me, they have been loving. On the contrary, there have also been people that have not been so loving and that have threatened me or told me that I was wrong or sinful or an abomination. They're worried for my soul. And I'm like, God and I are on this journey together. Like, you don't need to be worried about my soul. And I know there's still people out there that are, whether they're family or old friends, that think I'm wrong or I'm doing something against what God wants me to do. And I can't control that thought process. All I can do is continue to live my life and be true to myself and do my best to show them that my relationship with God is real and it's vibrant and I'm living a good life. And this transition is what I needed to not only be healthy and stable, but to want to live. If you look at the fruit of somebody's transition, are they better off in life? Are they more stable, more at peace, more happy, more capable of being a professional and a contributing member of society and honoring their place in the kingdom of God and the gifts that he's put in their life? Or are they struggling even harder? I don't know if you can show me a trans person that's struggling even worse once they come out as trans and start embracing that, unless there's a lot of opposition or something like that. But the testosterone has leveled me out completely. I think I was having a significant hormonal imbalance, and because my really erratic mood started when my cycle began at 13. And so when I started T, it completely leveled me out, in addition to accepting myself as a male and starting to live in society, which was very hard for the first couple of years. You know, I still didn't have facial hair. My voice hadn't dropped yet. So people just thought I was a lesbian named Lucas. And that was annoying. After a while, you just work through it and you start getting a beard, hopefully. And like Xander and I have, you just do better. And I have been 8.5 years now into my transition. I am happy. I am at peace 100%. It's interesting because I used to be afraid to die. When I was suicidal for so many years, I was terrified to die, which kind of doesn't make sense, right? And now that I'm not suicidal, I'm not afraid to die. And I realized that a couple years ago. I was just thinking about death, pondering it. And I was like, you know, I'm not afraid to die anymore, which was a feeling that I never didn't have. I remember from a very young age being afraid. I even asked my mom when I was a kid, what happens when you die? And I think it was because somebody in the family had threatened that if I told. But it's just something that stuck with me. And I'm not afraid to die. If I go now, then to me, that means my work is done and I'm ready to go meet my maker. So I don't want to die. I mean, I want to be here. I want to help as much as I can, right? But the fact that I'm not afraid anymore, I think speaks volumes.
You said something really powerful. You said the CEO of the group home said to you, I don't know how to help you. You know how to help people. Have you gone back?
I have. Yeah. The group home is no longer in operation, but I'm still in touch with the staff. I consider them close friends and family. I mean, I just went up there a few weeks ago and to the property. It's a couple hours from me. And it had been about 2 years since I was there last. And I talked to the CEO for 5.5 hours and her husband and her granddaughter. It was very powerful. She was honest with me. She didn't hold back, and I didn't need her to. And I was honest with her. And we were able to listen to each other's concerns and biases. And just, she's like, Lucas, when I just see these gay and trans people being so like loud and vile sometimes, it turns us off. In this little country town, that's all we see. We don't see somebody that's how they're actually living their life. And I was like, yeah, well, that's the problem, is we've been pushed out so hard by the church into the margins that when we have to feel like we have to be seen, we have to be dramatic about it or super like gay pride. And there's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes it can paint a picture of like how everything is and we're just out of control. And so I just had a really deep conversation with her and explained how being trans is medical. It's science. There's science behind it. It's not a moral situation. It's a medical situation. Just like all these other birth defects or things that children are born with, we cannot control being trans. Like the children that are born intersex, you know, they don't fit into a binary of male and female. So how do you expect anybody who's trans to fit into that when there are people documented that don't? 1.7% of the population are intersex. That's equivalent to the amount of redheads that walk this earth. So I just had a really positive conversation, and I don't know where she stands with all of it right now, but it's been years of her. And she did say, you know, Lucas, I try not to judge. I don't know where people are at. I can't understand everything because I'm human. One of my closest friends in the group home, she committed suicide years ago. And I think that really shook her. The CEO, because this girl had major giftings, very anointed, was a light, and she struggled with schizophrenia, which later ended a suicide attempt. And I think that really showed the CEO that just we don't have it all always figured out. And we have to extend a little more grace and compassion towards each other who are just doing the best that they can. If a trans person feels like they need to transition and change part of their body or take hormones or change their name to be happy and to be at peace and to be stable, then let's let them do it. You know, like, what does that really hurt? I feel like God doesn't care about that. I feel like on one hand, he cares about what concerns his children, right? So if something's upsetting me, if something's causing me suffering and grief, he cares about that. So therefore he wants to address it. And if my solution, our solution is for me to transition, then go for it. And I 100% feel God behind me on that and with me. And on the other hand, I feel like God looks at our soul. The Bible says that he looks at our heart. And if he sees our heart and our spirit and how we're living our life, then what does gender or being trans or being gay have anything to do with that?
Thank you so much, Lucas, for opening up like that. I really appreciate it. Sandra, do you have anything that you would like to say?
I have so many things I want to say. There's so much of your backstory, Lucas, that resonates with mine as well. There's some really interesting overlaps that I was also in a group home for girls when I was young. It was also very rural. It was in the country or the mountains, actually, in San Diego County. I'm very fortunate. That's what I count myself as, that I wasn't driven into trafficking. The reason for that is that as a young teenager, even in the group home, I ran away a lot. And when I wanted to get from point A to point B, I hitchhiked. And so I took rides from strangers. And, you know, typically it's men who pick up hitchhikers, not women, right? Even as I was a young girl, but I was very masculine appearing. So people probably would have thought I was a young teenage boy. And so I was getting picked up by men, total strangers, random people driving down the road who offered to take me in. I stayed at their homes. And so that happened on a number of occasions. And it's not to say terrible things didn't happen, but it could have been so much worse. But something that resonates with me, what you're talking about, is you were part of this youth group, and it was an older woman who was lesbian, who was the one that led you away from the church and into a night, which could have turned out to be the rest of your life if that wonderful officer hadn't intervened. And when I was 17 years old, I found myself in a relationship with a 24-year-old woman as a young lesbian back in the day myself. I'm a trans man for first listeners. And because you're probably wondering why I'm saying I'm a lesbian with this voice. And that relationship It was terrible. She was an alcoholic, and I didn't really understand that because I wasn't raised around alcoholism and drug addiction. She was very mentally controlling, physically abusive, financially controlling, taking my paychecks away from me. She was sexually abusive. I was so taken out of my understanding of reality, because I was raised that you can trust women and women are safe. And here was this woman that I was in relationship with, And it was so disorienting. So it's different from you, but I see some interesting similarities. I've always been really reluctant to talk about my experiences in childhood and adolescence with sexual assault because it does rub me the wrong way when people say, oh, those gay and lesbian people, but mostly lesbians and trans people, it's all because of sexual trauma, right? So I find myself being kind of reluctant to talk about it, but it seems poignant to the topic we're discussing today that, but I want to preface, not every single person who's lesbian or trans has sexual assault histories or sexual trauma histories, but do you encounter people who just make that assumption that you're trans, you transitioned because you wanted to be perceived of as a man in order to protect yourself, in order to be safer in the world? I know I've heard that. I don't really know how to respond to it most of the time, but it sounds like people can't see you're nodding your head. So it sounds as if you have encountered it. What do you say to people when they bring up that idea, that concept?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that I've been asked and it has been assumed, especially in the trainings that I did at the LGBT Center. I would go to a lot of different organizations and train on LGBT awareness. And a question that we often got was, isn't somebody gay or trans because they were abused as a child or because there's a neglectful parent, a daddy issue? Which now granted, I do have daddy issues, or I did, but I feel like sometimes all of our situations, they do impact one another. Maybe there to an extent, I did feel safer with women because I was a lesbian for a couple years as an adult because it wasn't safe for me to be with a guy, but it was highly uncomfortable to be with a guy as a girl. So when I transition, I'm actually a gay trans guy. I like men now, and I've only been with men since my transition. And I equate that as like, I'm comfortable being with a man as a man. There's a totally different dynamic there. It's so incredibly foreign and awkward to me even consider dating a female at this point. Like, I'm like, how does that work? So even though I was a lesbian for a long time, I do not relate whatsoever on a romantic level or relational with a woman, but yet I'm more comfortable with them on like a friend basis or like my pastor's a woman. But back to your question, I have met plenty of people that are either trans or gay or non-binary or bisexual or whatever that have not ever encountered sexual trauma, physical abuse, parental neglect. My younger years, I did wonder because I would hear that all the time and I was still trying to figure myself out and kind of all you see is your sphere, right? Your experience. And I thought, well, maybe I am this way because of things that have happened. But as I grew and healed, for one, if I've walked through so much healing and I'm still gay or I'm still trans, to me, that says something. And then as I've met people throughout my life that truly have not had this kind of trauma, and I don't think it's just because they're blocking it out, and they're still gay or trans, then I think that is also what has led me to understand deeper that this is how we're born. It's an innate situation for each person. And although there might be some environmental or cultural influences in somebody's gender identity or sexual orientation, I think ultimately, it's just who you are. Like a straight person is naturally attracted to the opposite gender, right? They didn't have to think about that when they were in elementary school or developed their first crush. They just are, you know, little Jimmy is attracted to little Bobby Sue. In some of our cases, little Jimmy was attracted to Johnny and it was very natural. Or the little girl felt like a boy. When I was 12, I literally felt like I had something very different in between my legs. And it was in between my ears that I felt that way. Like my body reacted like there was not what I had. And so it was very dysphoric to look down and see that. And I was like, what is going on? It freaked me out. And that was when hormones started and puberty. And it's like my body just went into chaos. And so I feel like it's incredibly important to note that this is not a byproduct of being abused. And even if it was where that stigma comes in, because like people need healing and grace, right? So even if it was, but it's not. And so I think we can get off that train and recognize it for what it is.
Absolutely.
We are taking our second commercial break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. We are speaking with our guest, Lucas Hall.
You had mentioned something about you went through a process of unlearning through probably through therapy and some other work that you were doing, and that you also took the time to consider things within yourself, things about yourself. And I think oftentimes, right, I think the introspection and the reflection is so important, right? As a clinician myself, I think that's really important. And I worry that oftentimes people see that as victim blaming. What is it about you and the way you were and the way you were interacting in the world made you probably more vulnerable to being selected, or the word people like to use is groomed, right? Being targeted. And so when you talk about there were things within yourself that you needed to unlearn, what are some of the things that you're talking about?
A lot of that was like, what do healthy relationships look like? It's not normal for your dad to hit your mom and to scream at you. And that's what I grew up with. The boundaries that weren't set for me because adults were constantly crossing those boundaries. Those are some of the things that I've had to unlearn. Unlearning that I'm not bad because one of my parents says that I am, or that I'm not unlovable because one of my parents says that I am. When one of your parents treats you like they wish you weren't there, it makes an impression. And that's something that you carry with you throughout your life in everything. So in every relationship and in school and in all these situations, am I good enough? What do I have to do to belong or to feel like I'm worthy of respect and protection? Because I never had that. And so I had to teach myself, Lucas, you can protect yourself. You deserve protection. And this is how you look for signs of what's unhealthy, right? Like, I've been in some pretty turbulent relationships because I didn't know how to have a healthy one. I didn't know what to look for. But as far as the victim blaming, yeah, I mean, I wasn't, even if I was, this doesn't excuse it by any means, but I wasn't like walking around asking people to do things to me or flirting with grown men. That was not me at all. I've asked my therapist this, and I've asked people this question. And the question is, why do people keep hurting me? Why do I keep getting targeted for sexual trauma? It happened everywhere. Boys from church, school teachers, parents in the neighborhood, older boys in the neighborhood. I mean, it was ridiculous. Everywhere I went, it's like people could like smell it on me that I was an easy exploit, which I don't understand. I mean, I was a very fun, loving kid, just friendly and happy generally, but very troubled. And a friend of mine recently told me, who's very charismatic as well, and has done a lot in the deliverance ministry spiritually, that there's a spirit of victimization that can happen and occur. And I do believe that we live in a spiritual world where things like that can absolutely exist. And then I've had therapists tell me that predators can sense vulnerability. If a child has been abused, people that do that abuse can generally pick up on that. So I just think there's a lot of work to be done in this area.
Absolutely. You said it. It's in a different way. I'll just use different terms, but it's pervasive, these kinds of traumas. You've been through a lot, and interwoven into your life story is your experience with the church, with your faith, your relationship with God. A lot of people would have given up. They would have felt abandoned by God. They would have felt neglected by the church, right? It was a person at your church who walked you out into that night of trauma. It was, as you mentioned, it was boys at church. It was a preacher at church, right? That were part of also the group of perpetrators. But here you are, and you and I have discussed this offline, that you're still very much involved in the church, and you've studied religion. I also studied religion in college, and you are engaged in work in the church. I have been doing that off and on throughout my life. I went to seminary, I have a master's in theology, and I should have walked away a long time ago, most people think. And for some reason, I've been tethered to not a particular kind of church or a particular denomination even, because I'm very much interested in Eastern philosophies like Taoism and Buddhism and Jainism, as well as Christianity and Islam, certain forms of it. And I'm very fascinated by what is called the perennial wisdom, right? Which is like this wisdom that comes from all these different traditions, and how really similar. There's a lot of similarities in the wisdoms from these traditions. Ken Wilber wrote a book years ago called Perennial Wisdom. And I really enjoy that concept and learning more about it. I'm not sure if you know this. There are some really wonderful organizations, and I want our audience to know that there's so many. I'm just going to mention three. There's an organization called Trans Faith, and they've been around for many, many years. Transfaith.info or .info. This is what would be considered interfaith organization made up of trans people who are clergy, who are lay leaders, leaders in a lot of different Christian, Jewish, Islamic, and Hindu, and a lot of other faith traditions, transfaith.info. There's also the Transmission Ministry Collective, Transmission Ministry Collective at transmissionministry.com. This is a ecumenical, meaning it's Christian of all the different denominations, and perhaps even some Catholics involved in that. And it's headed up by a gentleman who is a trans man who is a seminary graduate as well. And then there's Virtual Grace at virtualgrace.org. Virtual Grace is run by the Reverend Dr. Megan Rohr, who is a clergy in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, who's going to be one of our guests on a future show. So I'm looking forward to interviewing the Reverend Rohr. Reverend Rohr and I met in seminary, actually. And so we've done a lot of work together. I'm involved in Virtual Grace also. Something I was thinking about, because of your experience in doing trainings with law enforcement and your church background and your future experience with continuing in your studies of religion and ministry, Reverend Rohr was a San Francisco Police Department chaplain. And I find that that is a really wonderful position to be in, right? As a trans person, I believe still non-binary identified on testosterone, presenting very male in appearance, Reverend Rohr, working for the San Francisco Police Department as a chaplain and being able to do that one-on-one work with police officers has been really rewarding for them. And they're not doing that work anymore because they've moved on to doing other things, but really wonderful opportunity, especially because there's so much history in the community, trans, LGBT, trans in the broader sense, with law enforcement. And so to be able to bridge that, I think it can be a very healing experience. And so that's one individual of many that I know who have done that kind of work. What's in the future for you as far as your studies, and are you looking towards the future?
So I actually got a full scholarship to seminary offered to me last month, and I've accepted it. So I will be starting my seminary journey in August. And my goal right now is to become a chaplain. So I'll be getting my Master's of Divinity. I'm super drawn to chaplaincy work. Again, that's that one-on-one, being in presence with people, really just sitting with them, see myself speaking in front of thousands internationally and praying over people.
We have come to the end of our hour. Lucas, I want to thank you for joining us today. And I'm hoping that we can have you back. We always want our guests to return because our audience learns so much. We learn so much. It's a real gift to the world. So thank you.
Thank you.
Tune into the Umbrella Hour next time. We will be airing a show with Reverend Megan Rohr. We hope you will join us. Thank you for listening.